The entertainment industry is still about a $700 billion a year business in the United States alone, give or take a few recession dollars. L.A. is the creative capital since 1995. Sam Brown's For the Record has brought you interesting and informative guests who are among the industry's movers, shakers, and decision makers in a weekly, unprecedented, unvarnished look through the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth into what really goes on behind the scenes in the recording, film, and television industries. We are also fierce advocates for the rights of those in the creative community, be they songwriters, composers, actors, writers, artists, directors, producers, all those who use their unionized creativity to enhance the lives of the human experience around the globe. And we also explore how the shifting, prevailing, and sometimes howling winds of Washington, Sacramento, and L.A. politics affect all of us here in Hollywood. Good evening, and welcome to Sam Brown's For the Record. I'm Sam Brown, your host on this one-of-a-kind worldwide radio talk show. Tonight's show, we taped on Sunday, so we won't be doing any live call-ins. I wish we had, but we're going to have our guests back. Not to fret. This evening, we pick up with the show we were doing during the fun drive on the book titled Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage, with the author, William Lauren Katz, who will be our guest once again for the hour by phone. Now, as I mentioned in our last show, I've seen some statistics that report as many as 70% and as few as 30% of the 13 million African Americans in the United States, including yours truly, have some Native American blood in their lineage or DNA. Mr. Katz will probably have a more accurate statistic. In my case, I have Native American and West Indian on both sides of my family. But regardless of the stats, the historical fact is that the relationship between Native Americans and African Americans goes back some 600 years, about 75 years before the first recorded white settlement at Jamestown. It is a fascinating relationship, and I'm sure that you will be just as surprised as I was to hear about what U.S. history, for the most part, those historical depositories, in particular in Texas, has neglected to tell us about when we were going to junior high and high school. That's our show for today. Black Indians, a hidden heritage. And we'll be back in 60 seconds.
You're listening to Sam Brown's For the Record on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 93.7 San Diego, 98.7 Santa Barbara, and 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Listen live worldwide at www.kpfk.org.
From the book, Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage, let me quote this passage. Quote, "The first paths to freedom taken by runaway slaves led to Native American villages, where black men and women found acceptance and friendship among our country's original inhabitants. And though they are rarely mentioned in our history books or our Hollywood movies, the children of Native and African-American marriages helped shape the early days of the fur trade and added a new dimension to frontier diplomacy and made a daring contribution to the fight for American freedom and liberty." I'm sure a lot of you know that the first American killed, actually we weren't known as Americans back then, but the first American killed in the Revolutionary War was a black man by the name of Atticus Crispus. Our guest this evening is the author of the book Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage. It is a book that gives us a historically accurate chronology of African Americans and the extent of the relationship they had with Native Americans from the early 16th century through the early 20th century. And we are very, very pleased to have back with us again the author of the book, William Loren Katz. He has also authored some 40 other books, including Breaking the Chains, African American Slave Resistance, The Black West, and Black Women of the Old West. Two books I'd like to read, as a matter of fact. Black West and Black Women of the Old West. He has lectured in Europe, Africa, and throughout the United States, and has served as a scholar in residence at Teachers College, Columbia University, my alma mater, as well as a consultant to the Smithsonian Institute and School Systems from California to Florida and England. Mr. Katz, are you there?
How are you?
I'm doing quite well. How are you? And for the sake of, I've let our listeners know that my heritage is Native American and West Indian, and that I'm also Jewish.
Okay.
You're Jewish.
Yes.
How did you get interested in Black American and Black Indians?
Well, I grew up in a very unusual family. In the 1930s, my father first took a great interest in jazz music, and then he began to collect books on Black history. So I was probably one of the few white kids in the world to grow up surrounded by books by W.E.B. Du Bois and Frederick Douglass and so on. And then I started teaching high school, junior high school in New York. And I, of course, the textbooks were appalling in what they didn't report and what they said about what African Americans contributed. So I began adding my material, and I got into the whole subject since I loved cowboy and Indian movies of the West.
You know, I said as an
Africans and Native Americans that are left out of our traditional books, and that's how it came about.
I said as an aside in my open that Texas was a state where a lot of these history books that we all read throughout the United States were put together. Was that not accurate?
Well, what was put together there, did you say?
The history books we read in junior high and high school.
Well, Texas has a kind of a veto power over textbooks because they order for the entire state, and that's been a very grievous kind of decision the publishing industry has made, because they exclude a lot of materials they don't like.
Right. Being in the South, that includes a lot of Black history. And I also find it ironic that that's where Lee Harvey Oswald shot President Kennedy from a Texas book depository. And just irony. Tell me, we've heard about the Underground Railroad, but very, very, very little. And those were, the Underground Railroad largely went north for slaves who were able to run away. And, of course, it was a euphemism for the road to freedom for those slaves.
Right.
But there was another road that went south, which I suppose you could call the Moccasin Trail. Give us a thumbnail sketch on what the Moccasin Trail was.
Well, let me first start by saying this. That in order to understand about slavery and African Americans running away and being taken in by Native Americans, we have to understand a fact of history that most people don't know, which is that the first people enslaved here in the Americas, here in the United States, here wherever you're standing or wherever I'm standing, were Native Americans.
Right.
And Africans were then fed into this slave system. And so the two peoples knew they had the same enemy. They weren't brought together by any kind of similarity of skin color. They knew they had the same enemy, and they found other things in common, which we can get into.
And Native Americans were found to have to be more susceptible to European illnesses than Africans were.
You know, that's absolutely true. They were wiped out in many cases by such diseases as smallpox and other things. They had no immunity for that. The Africans, on the other hand, turned out to have immunity for the almost entirely from these European diseases because they had had contact
right.
with Europeans earlier.
Right, right. Okay, go ahead. I don't want to get down too far down the medical trail, but yes, I
no,
thought
no,
that's,
it. That's an important point. But let's get back to your moccasin trail because it's an important point. We have a letter by Nicolas Ovando of Hispaniola. That's where Haiti and the Dominican Republic are today. And 1502, Governor Ovando is writing to King Ferdinand that his African slaves who had just been brought over, he had brought them over just that same year in the ship that brought him over as a new governor, had escaped and fled to the Indians, and then he used this phrase, and never could be captured.
Right.
Never could be captured. Now, I believe in those four words, he's talking about what we may call the first rainbow coalition
mm-hmm.
taking place in the Americas. He's talking about a joint resistance by two peoples of color who find they have something very important in common. Native Americans want to keep their land and freedom, and African Americans want to find their freedom. And so you're right. The Moccasin Trail leads let me put it this way. The Underground Railroad does not first lead north. It later does that by the 1800s. But first, it leads to wherever Native Americans are willing to take in African Americans, and they are willing because they suffered the same fate initially. And in addition to that, they're having their land taken from them by the European conquerors.
And that goes back to the 16th and 17th century, even though later in the 18th century, there were several nations. I'm jumping ahead of myself, but we may as well jump into this.
Sure.
There were the five nations, right? That in the 18th century, and I think they were the Chickasaw, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Creek, and Seminole. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
All right. Ultimately, they became known as the Four because one of those five nations refused to take Africans and turn them into slaves, which were the Seminoles. Is that so?
Let me just back up and come at that in another way.
Okay.
The Europeans tried every trick in the book, every diplomatic move that they could make to play red people off against black people.
Correct.
I don't understand that.
Correct.
Huge bribes of, if a native group would capture an African, they'd pay them three muskets and four blankets and things like that that were outrageous because they were really buying divide and rule.
Right.
And one of the techniques that they hit on in about the 18th century was introducing slavery, African slavery, to what they call the five nations of the southern states that you just mentioned.
Right.
And to the extent that these nations accepted Africans as slaves, and they did, here were their gifts, they'll work for you and so on, they were called the five civilized nations.
Right. I forgot that word, civilized.
Definition.
Right.
Of civilization. Okay, they did accept, but not in the way the Europeans wished them to. None of the five nations just took them in and brutalized them in the way that African enslaved people were being brutalized in the southern states. They took them in, and after a while, they were eating at the same table. They were marrying the daughter of the household, and they were often becoming free.
Right.
At the end of a certain amount of time when they were accepted into the village. But this was an effort to keep Africans from escaping to the Native American villages that of the five nations that you mentioned and others. Some of them were heading up north, and they were getting into Canada, and Chief Pontiac was taking them in, and other Native American leaders. So this was the part of the divide-and-rule effort of the Europeans to introduce slavery and so on.
And I'd just like to add for our listeners, present day, how historically human beings throughout the world have divvied up the divided and conquer in order to conquer people, various peoples, based on skin color as opposed to language and religion. Most Europeans, if you can see today in Ireland, you've got the same people divided by religion. Irish versus English. These are not people divided by color. Or even in Africa, the Hutus versus the Tutsis were divided by language, not color. They're all black. just as Irish and English are all white. It was when the Europeans came here and they saw mixed colors. They saw, colors other than their own white skin, that they saw a way to profitize and to exploit those individuals. Would you not agree?
Yes. This divide and rule was absolutely essential here in the Americas because the Europeans saw themselves as outnumbered. They had the guns, they had the whips, but the thing they feared most, and you can read it right in their writings and their pronouncements, was that an alliance might take place between the Africans and Native Americans. And it did. It did, beginning with that 1502 report of Africans escaping to Native Americans in Hispaniola and never would be captured.
Now, there is another history which we can get to, particularly dealing with California. But because of Spanish and the introduction of Spain and Mexico, Mexicans and Spanish were another group that infiltrated and mixed with those groups in your chapter in your book called Their Mixing is to be Prevented.
Oh, yes. Well, when you talk about Mexico, and even for that matter, the rest of South America, the mixture of Africans and Native Americans became so complete and so thorough that the Spaniards were kind of driven to a kind of sputtering fury trying to devise different categories of calling people, mulatto, and they had all of these different categories, something like 16 categories to dividing the races. But the important thing is that you had emerging from this mixture a fellow like Vicente Guerrero in Mexico, who is a mule driver. He doesn't learn to read and write till he's age 40. He's a mixture of African and Native American descent. He becomes a revolutionary. They're trying to throw off Spanish rule. And in 1829, he becomes president of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
This black Indian. Guerrero province is named, the southernmost province of Mexico is named after this man. What does he do as president?
Mm-hmm.
He abolishes slavery. He writes the Constitution of Mexico. He abolishes discrimination, and he even abolishes the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have called him the George Washington, as well as the Abraham Lincoln of Mexico, and he's left out of the history books.
Well, the history books that were put together in Texas. Anyway,
yes.
You've brought us up to the early 19th century, 1829, and you address the fact that so many of the historical fur traders and mountain men like Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Jim Bowie, and Kit Carson. I used to read a lot about those guys when I was in junior high school. I just loved those books. And Jim Bridger interacted with black American Indians like a guy like James Beckwith. Tell us who James Beckwith was.
Okay. James Beckwith was an indentured servant. He was a mixture of African and Native American parentage. And he headed out of Missouri around 1821, out of St. Louis, and he headed west. And he actually became, Sam, as famous as those other characters you mentioned, the Daniel Boones, the Jim Bowies, the Jim Bridgers, and so on, that we found in our Hollywood movies. And he became an important go-between, as did a number of other fur trappers. And in 1850...
He was in the movie Tomahawk.
Well, let me get to that.
Was that him?
That's what I'm working up to.
Okay.
In 1850, he discovers a pass through the Sierra Nevada Mountains that leads into the California gold fields. 1850, the gold strike is 1849.
Right.
So it's a very important pass. And by the way, if you look at any map of California, look at that northern section. It is still, there's a Beckwith Pass, there's a town of Beckwith, and there's even a Beckwith Peak. I think it's Route 70, I'm not sure. But it's right near Reno, Nevada, into northern California. And now let me come to the movie. Yes, in 1951, Universal International makes the Technicolor classic Tomahawk. And Jim Bridger is in it, and Jim Beckwith is in it. Only Jim Beckwith is played by the actor Jack Oakey.
Right.
Jack Oakey was a fine actor, good comedian. He played Mussolini against Charlie Chaplin's Hitler in The Great Dictator, but he's a white man.
Right.
So everybody learns Beckwith is important, and nobody learns that he is indeed a man of color who really did very important things in California and in the rest of the country. He's all over the country, by the way. He's in the California Bear Flag Rebellion. He's fighting in Florida. He's a scout for the U.S. Army. He helps bring murderers to justice.
I saw a picture of him, and I got to tell you, he does look like the kind of guy you don't want to mess with.
You wouldn't want to sit down and have dinner with him.
Yeah.
Well, at least you wouldn't want to bring your back on him.
he was rough. Tell us about, while we're going through these historical figures, tell us about Edward Rose.
Well, Edward Rose was another one in the Jim Beckwith tradition. He was a tough, as a matter of fact, his nickname was Cut Nose. He had gotten in some kind of fight and had a cut that, you know, remained on his face for the rest of his life. And he was just one of the others out there in the wilderness who was of African descent, who got along very well with Native Americans. And that's the point I think I want to get to as we talk about the fur trappers. The old fur trappers often got a person of color of African descent to negotiate for them with the Native Americans because they trusted them better and there was less friction. And this is from a report by a white gentleman who worked for the Smithsonian Institution at that time, way back, lived for 28 years with Native Americans. And it's an untold part of our history that Africans were brought over here actually in the early days, soon after Columbus, as translators and negotiators with
right.
Native Americans.
Right.
They evidently picked up languages very quickly. I know there were many, many languages and dialects spoken in Africa. And they didn't come weighted down with racial prejudice, and they were able to, as far as the Europeans were concerned, put on a much better front than they could with Native Americans who were learning pretty darn quickly to not trust the Europeans.
Right. And that has to do with a lot of other things that exists in our society to this day about, you know, I have theories as to how and why black people in this country really know whites better than whites know black.
Uh-huh.
I mean, way better. And know their ways, et cetera, because blacks have never tried to separate themselves from whites. But anyway, that goes on. It gets into another thing. I don't want to talk about that today. We'll get into that in another story. Let's take a break, and we'll come back, and I want to hear about how that was used, the fact that Africans could pick up the Native American languages and their dialects so quickly, and whites discovered they could use them to do the negotiating as the country moved west. William Lorne Katz is our guest this evening. The book is called Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage. It's a fascinating book. Covers a lot, almost 200 years of history that you did not get when you were in junior high school or high school. Bill Katz will be right back with us. He's on the phone. I'm Sam Brown. This is Sam Brown's For the Record, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Sally Kellerman, and you're listening to Sam Brown's For the Record, the only talk show in the country dedicated to the behind-the-scenes of the entertainment business, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. It's more than just talk.
Bill Katz is our guest today. The book he is the author of is Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage. Bill, where can we pick up a copy of the book?
Well, it should be, you know, you should be able to get it from any bookseller. You can request it. An easy way, by the way, is to go to my website, williamlkatz.com.
That's what I was trying to get you to say.
Read some of the reviews, even see some of the pictures. And I have a big article there on Black Indians, kind of summarizing my research and you know, seeing people can read it and see if they're interested in the book.
That's what I wanted to get you to say. WilliamLKatz.com yes. is the website. And I invite you all, and I'll mention it again at the end of the show, to check him out there. All right, let's go back to you were talking about Edward Rose.
Yeah, well, Edward Rose was an example of the kind of middleman role that many people of African descent played in the early days of the Americas. It was a Jan Rodriguez in New York City who was here working for the Dutch around the time Henry Hudson came. And he was set up, and he was a man of African descent. He had a Spanish name, as a number of them did. He was not enslaved. We're not talking about enslaved people here. The first Africans brought here were brought here by the Spanish and the Portuguese, and they were free men. And they were brought here because of their skills as translators. And then they became, of course, negotiators, and some of them even rose to become diplomats. And you have this throughout American history. You have York with the Lewis and Clark expedition, an over 6 foot tall, muscular African who really is very important to the expedition, negotiating with the Native Americans and picking up their languages and working with the woman, Sacagawea, the Shoshone woman, who is also important to the expedition.
Right.
So there's a long tradition, and there's a name for them. They're called Atlantic Creoles, which means that these Africans had skills in languages, they had culture, they had crossed cultures between Africa, Europe, and the Americas, and they were very at home in dealing with people of different cultures, and of course they picked up languages quickly. So they became very valuable, first to the Portuguese and Spanish, and then to the other European powers that came over here in the colonial period.
It's unbelievable that there's so much rich history.
This is not in the history books again.
Say again?
It's not something we hear about.
Yeah, that is not something. You know, I want to tell our listeners that I thought I was pretty much a good student of African-American history, but I discovered so much in your book that even in African-American history classes we did not get, especially about people like Edward Rose and James P. Beckwith. And tell us about George and Stephen Bonga.
Well, there's a perfect example. You know, when I was a kid, we used to go to the movies on Saturdays. It was only 11 cents in the 1930s, and they saw three movies. And at least one of the three, sometimes two, were about they were Westerns. And if they were about the fur trappers were always white people with names like McTavish or Sherrin Bonneau. In other words, they were always Scotch-Irish,
right,
or they were French. Well, the Bonga brothers, George and his brother Pierre there, they were up in Leech Lake, Minnesota, about as far north as you can get into Minnesota, and they were very important. They were jet black, and they were very important to the fur trade. Matter of fact, both of them married Chippewa women, and George negotiated a treaty, a very important treaty for the United States with the Chippewas back in the 1820s.
Speaking of treaties, and we're moving through history very fast, and for those of our listeners who really find this book and this discussion fascinating, we're going to do more. Mr. Katz has graciously agreed to come back on our show again. But talk about the Indian Removal Act of 1830, also known as the Trail of Tears.
Well, that's a very interesting example of what role the United States was taking in its attitude toward Native people and people of African descent.
Like black Cherokees.
Right.
Yeah.
Each of the five nations that lived in the southern states at that point was given orders that they had to move. Didn't matter how civilized they were, didn't matter how peaceful they were, didn't matter how well integrated they were into the economy and the agriculture at the time, they had to pick up and go. And the U.S. Army was sent in to move the Cherokees. They sent in 7,000 soldiers, and they made a forced march in which many died. And at this time of the march, of course, many of the people were of African as well as Native American descent, not only among the Cherokees, but the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, Creeks, and so on. And they were pushed all the way out to Oklahoma. so that the white people in those areas could have the land, and there was some gold discovered on the Cherokee land. That was one of the reasons they wanted them out. They were on prize land that other people wanted to settle, and they were just forcibly removed. And as I said, they were sent to Oklahoma. And the president of the United States at the time of the completion of this, Van Buren, reported that it was all done very peacefully. There was no problem. There was no problem except that thousands of people died on the way. Some of them had to march in winter,
right,
without shoes. And, of course, many men, women, and children died. And this is it's a kind of incident that really I think we need to study much more in our history books. It was a gross example of genocide and of driving people into the wilderness, removing them from their homes, and forcing them to a new location, which, by the way, Oklahoma, nobody thought it was fit for habitation anyway, so let's send them there. And this was conducted by the Congress, and the Army conducted it, the Congress issued the orders, and the President enforced it.
And we won't discuss what happened when oil was discovered almost 100 years later in the Oklahoma territories.
Right.
Or the similarity in the Black Hills of the Dakotas in 1870 when gold was discovered.
Yes. Right,
but that's another story, and we'll talk about that. Let me ask you, Bill. How did whites react to the treatment that Indians gave the their slaves, with the exception of Chickasaws? How did they react to that?
First of all, the main what were called Indian agents, in other words, representing the federal government among the various nations, were Southerners, so they were pro-slavery. And they were appalled, as I point out in Black Indians, at the lenient treatment that the Native Americans and African men just shared everything.
Right.
We were eating out of the same pot, said one African American, talking about his experience with Native Americans. We were eating out of the same pot when you, he said to his brother, who had been living among whites and been oppressed by white slavery, while you were licking your master's boots.
Right.
And that led to a lot of difficulty for the Southern whites. They wanted these. That's one of the reasons they wanted the Native Americans moved. They didn't want that thing allowed. They wanted them out there.
Plus, they often intermarried.
When the war came, you had a group led by Apatha Yohola, a Creek leader who led thousands of men, women, and children, most of them of African descent, but not all of them, many just Native American descent, who tried to get out of the grip of the slaveholders there in Oklahoma and get to Kansas, where they would find liberty and be safe from oppression and slavery and so on. And in Kansas, by the way, they did get there. It was a grueling march, and many did not survive, but those that got there, among the young men, a number fought in the 2nd Kansas Colored Volunteers, it was called, Native Americans and African Americans and mixed together, and fought some of the earliest battles of the U.S. Civil War.
And oftentimes there were marriages between the slaves, the Africans, and the Indians in these groups, in these tribes,
yes.
But what they did was the Indian form of quote-unquote slavery was to consider them family.
Yes.
Which is why they ate out of the same pot. And if you were considered family, obviously sooner or later, men and women would get together.
Yes. Yeah, no, the thing, that's why people, I found that people who share this particular biracial heritage are very proud, because they know that their people, their ancestors, their grandfathers, their great-grandfathers and grandmothers came together not out of some forced situation which happened with whites who were slaveholders in the southern states, but out of choice, out of love, and out of marriage. Yes.
But, you know, let's just stick this in there. There was talk about the period where there were Indians who, Native Americans, who showed animosity towards the slaves as a result of dealing with the European Americans.
No, it's true. And you even had in 1842, you actually had a slave rebellion in the Cherokee Nation.
Right.
Where a number of the Africans just rose up and they said, well, look, the point is that slavery, even in its mildest form, means you do not have your freedom.
Right.
It means you cannot just go wherever you want. You cannot do everything that you want. And people escaped from slavery. The slaves escaped from the White House during the slave times. So why wouldn't some rise up and, you know, try to escape from the Cherokees or the Choctaws and others? The interesting thing, though, is that it generally does not appear to be that kind of harsh slavery that caused hundreds of slave rebellions and conspiracies in the southern states.
Yes. To which we are still dealing with attitudes similar that are 200-300 years ago, particularly in the South, but also in the North. And the slaves in the White House probably didn't know that one day there would be a black man in the White House. But ironically, President Obama does not have that heritage.
Right, right.
That his heritage.
His wife does, I believe.
Yes, his wife does. But that's because she's African American.
Right.
His father was African, Kenyan, and his mother was Irish.
Right.
So he doesn't have that heritage, ironically. All right, but let's move on to talking about, I want to talk about the interesting history that Africans and Native Americans have here in California. There was a guy named Francisco Reyes.
Francisco Reyes was, well, let me just start. The Los Angeles was founded, I believe the year was 1791,
mm-hmm.
by a group of 44 people, of which 26 were of African descent, and most of the others were of Native American descent. One was even of Chinese descent.
Mm-hmm.
And Francisco Reyes, I believe he, I don't want to mix him up with somebody else. I think he owned the San Fernando Valley. And he gave it up. He got bored with it. And he instead came in and he ran for and was elected mayor of Los Angeles.
Right. When I read that, I found it so ironic that when I first came out to L.A. about 30 years ago, I was told there were places in the San Fernando Valley that I could not go after dark. And like I was told I couldn't cross Balboa Boulevard. You know, the LAPD do not like to see black faces after 7 o'clock at night. Anyway, but that's another story. You know, we're running out of time, and I want to cover a couple of more things. I want to talk about historical names from the Old West you don't hear about in U.S. history classes that include outlaws. There were obviously not everybody black and Native American were good guys. There were outlaws. But historically speaking, what whites have done is they've also lionized outlaws like Billy the Kid and Jesse James.
Yes.
Okay. But there were other outlaws just as infamous, including one who was killed so many deputies and so many people and was finally, he was like a Robin Hood, I understand it, and I just love this. He was captured, sentenced to die, escaped again, was recaptured, and the judge said, I wish I could sentence you to more than just death. And his last words, which I just thought were quite amusing, I'm sure a screenwriter hears it, it's going to get used. His last words that were recorded was when he was asked, do you have any last words? And he said, I came here to die, not make a speech. I love that.
Yeah, that was Cherokee Bill.
Cherokee Bill. Talk about Dick Glass and Cherokee Bill.
Well, let me start with Cherokee Bill was really in a tradition of Billy the Kid, but Billy the Kid, I have to tell you, was a didn't have anything on Cherokee Bill in either looks or anything like that. Billy the Kid was a buck-toothed, moronic, psychopathic mass murderer. By the way, he came from my hometown of New York City, as William Bonney. And Cherokee Bill actually grew up, he was the son of a African-American and a Native American woman with African descent. And he got in a fight at the age of 18 or so at a dance. Somebody cut in on him, wanted to dance with his partner, came back and with a gun and blew the man away. And from then on, he became a very notorious outlaw who it seemed like everybody in the world was chasing after, but was also terrified of. And also they could not capture him because since he was part Cherokee, he could ride through the Indian country and be at peace. And since he was terribly handsome, he had any number of women willing to put him up for the night and hasten him on his way in the morning so he would not be captured, until they finally did, of course, catch up to him and sentence him to death. And as you said, the judge looked down at him and said, "You are among the worst that I've ever had, but all I can do is sentence you to death." Yeah, that was Cherokee Bill. Dick Glass was, that was an outlaw gang. This was a whole period when the kind of, you might say, the sun was setting on the hopes of Native American and African people. This is the 1890s, and Jim Crow was coming in, segregation
right.
African Americans, the Plessy decision of the Supreme
right.
Court saying segregation is perfectly legal throughout the United States. And for Native Americans, the land was being taken away from them through the Allotment Act. Their children were being taken away and sent to white boarding schools
right.
and given religious instruction and told they couldn't mix with other children who spoke their language, and everybody had to speak English. And the sun was really setting on both peoples of color. So you had an outbreak of Black and Native American violence out in places like Oklahoma that Cherokee Bill was one. And Dick Glass headed up a gang that lashed out. They were lashing out. I'm not saying these people were fighting for freedom. I mean, they were cold-blooded killers. But in a way, you know, our outlaws represent our frustrated hopes in society. They don't have the right answer because they're arguing out of the barrel of a gun and they're killing people.
Right.
But they're saying something about the frustrations, the utter frustration of the particularly the young people of the time. What can they do? There's no place to get a good job. Your land is being taken from you. People are not treating you with respect, and you're not allowed to move around as you wish. And so you had this outbreak. And then, of course, there's the Rufus Buck Gang.
Right.
A mixture of African Americans and Native Americans. There's a picture of them in the Black Indians book. And they shot up the place right after Cherokee Bill did. Mm. And they killed more people than the Dalton and the Star Gang combined. And the picture photograph I have in it shows them on their next to last day on Earth. You can see the handcuffs holding these young men together. And when I say young, you can see they look to be, I would say, like young teens,
mm-hmm.
very young teens, 13, mm-hmm. 14. Looks like a junior high basketball team. And they're taken out. Once again, they're revolting against the curtain that's being drawn on their society and hopes as young people.
Let me, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Let me flip the script. There were also lawmen during yes. that particular time, and one of the more famous ones, U.S. Deputy Marshal, was a guy named Bass Reeves.
Right. Now, Bass Reeves was an extraordinarily lawman. He was in the Oklahoma Territory, and by the way, he was one of a number, I have some pictures in there, of other lawmen, deputy sheriffs who rode out of African and Native American descent. But Bass Reeves, he knew Native American languages, he was respectful of Native American culture, and he always got his man. And he was feared. I think he served for something like 37 years.
A long time, yeah.
Or something out there. And he's a legend in Oklahoma as well. He should be. He should be a movie. It should be a movie about a number of these people.
I was going to say there are several movies in your book.
Well, there certainly are. The story of the Seminole Negro Indian Scouts.
Yeah.
You talk about law and order. It's phenomenal. What they brought to Texas, Texas was at the border crossing there, the Rio Grande, was a rattlesnake country when it came to human beings. And they pacified it in a 12-year period, these black Seminoles out of Florida who came and became our best desert fighters the U.S. Army ever had.
Yep.
Four of them earned the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Right.
Three of them riding into 30 rustlers and picking up their white commander and riding out his bullets whistled all around them. And I'm not making this up. This is from the records in the National Archives.
Right, the congressional records. We're almost out of time, and I would be remiss if I didn't get you to just touch upon Bill Pickett, the Bulldogger.
Well, Bill Pickett was probably the greatest cowboy that ever lived. He invented the cowboy sport of bulldogging. You may not know it by that name, but you'd recognize it if you saw it. The cowboy leaps out of the saddle of his horse onto the back of a steer, grabs a horn in each hand, and twists it until he and the steer are rolling in the dust, and he's got control of the matters. Bill Pickett invented that and put a finale on it that was unusual. He would then lean over once he got the steer down, this huge beast, he'd bite the steer's lower lip and throw his hands in the air to show that was his only grip on the steer. Don't try it, by the way.
Ah. All right, there are so many more I want to talk about. Ednonia Lewis?
Right, that was the first great sculpture,
yeah, and she was part Indian. There were other.
The war had an African father.
There were others historically, people we know like Frederick Douglass and Langston Hughes.
Right.
And even today, people like Halle Berry, who can trace their lineage back that far. Bill,
and Michael Jackson.
Yeah. Oh, you could see the Indian in the Jacksons. In their faces with the cheekbones, and it's amazing history, and it's just so sad that the country is deprived of that history. You know, not every child in this country grows up to even know this exists.
Yes.
And I highly recommend to my audience and to anyone who tuned in today to get a copy of the book Black Indians. It's a great read, first of all. It's not just crammed with, historical facts. It's not a wonk book. It's very well put together. You did a great job. And Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage, William Lauren Katz. And the email address to your site is?
It's, my website is williamlkatz.com. And people can reach me. There's an email. They can reach me with comments or anything else. But at my website, they can find information on Black Indians, my other books, even some pictures and some essays they might find very interesting.
And the books include The Black West and Black Women of the Old West.
Yes.
And we're going to have you back to talk about that as well. Thank you so much, William Katz.
Thank you, Sam.
It's my pleasure to have met you.
Nice talking to you.
All right. That's it for this week's editions of Sam Brown for the Record. We thank all of you for joining us, and we thank you for your contributions in the last 3 weeks to the station and to this program, your pledges during our fund drive. Now, in the weeks to come, we should let you know that we've got some interesting shows coming up. One of the next shows we're going to do is called Is the Hollywood Casting Couch Dead? That's going to be a fascinating show. Considering military bands as a career. I don't know if many of you knew that I was in a military band, as was my father. So we're going to do that in these times, these crazy times. There are people who are musicians who are looking for gigs that aren't there. Did you think about the military? Not necessarily as a career now, even though my dad did a 40 years. I did not. But, you know, it's something you might want to think about. We're going to talk about how to do that. And it's not easy to get into. But we're going to talk about how to get into it. And to dovetail that, which made me think of this guy, his name is Denny Seiwell. Drummers out there probably know who he is because he was Paul McCartney's drummer in Wings. Unknown to many of you. And to many of you drummers, I was the guy who replaced Denny Seiwell in the Sixth Fleet when he went to join Paul McCartney. Trivia question. We're also going to do a show on signing called But Where Do I Sign? We're also going to do a show called Did Disco Really Die? If you listen to Lady Gaga and you like Lady Gaga, that's just disco version 2.0. Skills and Craft, All Hit Songwriters Use. We're going to do that. And When Do I Need a Publicist? We're going to do that as well. Our thanks to our senior producer, Dave Bent, our crew of associate intern producers, Matthew Kralinski, and who else we got in? We got Devin, and give me a name there. John Light. Okay. Thank you, John Light. I'm sorry. All right. Next up, Informativa Pacifica. I'm Sam Brown. For all of us here on Sam Brown's For the Record, be good to yourselves, kind, considerate, tolerant, and understanding with one another. Thank you for joining us. If you're on the road, drive carefully. Have a great evening. We'll see you next week.
Breakbeats and Rhymes Radio, hosted by Rebels to the Grain, every late Saturday night from 2 to 4 a.m., bringing hip-hop back to the airwaves.
But you can expect to hear not only dope hip-hop and rare grooves, but also be expected to be informed on what's cracking in your neighborhood. So sit back with us and let's spark this revolution.
So tune in as you're driving home from a late night, or as you're just chilling at home.
Every late Saturday night, 2 to 4 a.m., following the wonderful selections of Sound Waves Radio.
That's every late Saturday night, Sunday morning, from 2 to 4.
Right here on KPFK.
Hola, soy Dolores Huerta. Estás escuchando Radio Pacífica, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Ángeles. 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara, mundialmente por kpfk.org.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacífica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacífica. A solo 3 días de las elecciones presidenciales en Perú, compañías encuestadoras afirman Ollanta Humala y Keiko Fujimori se encuentran en empate técnico.
No solamente es que sean los Zetas quienes están ordeñando este combustible, sino que también estarían implicados personal de Petróleos Mexicanos. Además, nosotros documentamos que también habría investigaciones respecto de militares que estarían involucrados en este ilícito.
Demanda el gobierno mexicano a 9 empresas de Estados Unidos por la compra de petróleo robado.
Las recamareras, a través de la Nación, en 10 ciudades, están alzando sus voces para asegurar de que se entiendan los abusos que están pasando en los hoteles.
Recamareras de hoteles en Estados Unidos denuncian ser objeto frecuente de abusos. Un informe concluye que la guerra contra las drogas es un fracaso.
No es muy alentador el mundo donde hemos nacido, pero hay otro mundo en la barriga de ese mundo, esperando, que es un mundo diferente y de parición difícil, que hay otro mundo que puede ser latiendo en este mundo que es.
Y el escritor uruguayo Eduardo Galeano afirma que se gesta un nuevo mundo en las movilizaciones populares que demandan otro sistema político. A continuación, detalles de estas y otras noticias en la edición de hoy del Informativo Pacífica.
Iniciamos con algunas noticias destacadas en las últimas horas.
Falleció este jueves en Tanzania Jerónimo Yiyaga, ex miembro de la organización Panteras Negras. El luchador por la libertad de su pueblo afroamericano pasó 27 años encarcelado, 8 de ellos incomunicado por un crimen que no cometió. En 1997, un juez conservador del condado de Orange, en California, ordenó su libertad después de enterarse de que el testigo principal contra Jerónimo era un informante del FBI, dato que no se le comunicó al jurado que lo condenó. Jerónimo fue una de las tantas víctimas de COINTELPRO, el programa de contrainteligencia del gobierno diseñado para desacreditar, encarcelar y eliminar a disidentes políticos en Estados Unidos. La edición del viernes del Informativo Pacífica tendrá un amplio reporte sobre el legado del activista Jerónimo Yiyaga, quien falleció este jueves en África. A solo 3 días de las elecciones en Perú, los candidatos a la presidencia Ollanta Humala del partido Gana Perú y Keiko Fujimori de Fuerza 2011 cierran el jueves su campaña electoral con mítines políticos en Lima. El pasado miércoles la candidata derechista pidió disculpas a 300.000 mujeres indígenas que fueron esterilizadas sin su consentimiento durante el gobierno de su padre Alberto Fujimori, periodo en el que ella fungía como primera dama. Durante una entrevista realizada en la ciudad de Piura, Keiko Fujimori consideró las esterilizaciones forzadas como casos aislados.
Si es que han habido excesos por parte de algunos profesionales, yo los rechazo tajantemente. Yo, por supuesto, que expreso mis disculpas a las personas, en todo caso a esta señora u otra persona, si es que se le ha practicado la esterilización en contra de su voluntad, pero por supuesto lo rechazo y lo condeno.
El expresidente Alberto Fujimori purga sentencia de 25 años por crímenes cometidos contra la población civil durante su gobierno. A solo días de las elecciones presidenciales, encuestadoras dicen existe un empate técnico entre la candidata de la derecha, Keiko Fujimori, y el líder nacionalista Ollanta Humala. Expertos afirman que cada voto será importante el próximo domingo. Lázaro Agüero, secretario general del partido Gana Perú en California, señala que el voto de los peruanos que viven en el exterior consolidará el triunfo de Ollanta Humala.
Todo voto es importante, sea el nacional, de los peruanos que están viviendo en el Perú y de todos los peruanos que viven en Europa, Latinoamérica y en Estados Unidos. Cada voto va a contar. Como representante aquí de Gana Perú, tenemos la plena certeza de que Ollanta Humala va a ganar en el Perú. El voto en el extranjero va a apoyar para determinar esa decisión. Todas las encuestas están dando ganador o un empate técnico. Primero daban ganador a Keiko Fujimori, pero ahora están dando un empate técnico. Y mayormente siempre esas encuestadoras han favorecido a los candidatos de la derecha, en este caso a Keiko Fujimori, al punto que ya ahorita ya no pueden mentir más o ya no pueden engañar más. Están diciendo que hay un empate técnico, pero la realidad, lo que se ve en el país, cómo es recibido ya Antimal a todos los lugares a donde va, es que tenemos la plena certeza de que las elecciones se van a ganar en el Perú, con el apoyo también de todos los votos aquí en el extranjero. En Estados Unidos hay buena cantidad de votantes, en California, en lo que es Los Ángeles, hay un promedio de 9.500 votantes.
Federaciones de estudiantes chilenos efectuaron el miércoles un paro nacional en defensa de la educación pública y protagonizaron marchas en las principales ciudades de ese país. En Santiago, la capital chilena, se estimó en 30.000 los manifestantes que rechazaron el modelo de educación instaurado durante la dictadura de Pinochet, que privilegia la educación privada. Denunciaron también que el presidente Sebastián Piñera busca entregar mayores recursos a las escuelas privadas. Los estudiantes de secundaria, preparatoria y universidad fueron acompañados por profesores, académicos y otros trabajadores que comparten su reclamo por un cambio estructural en la educación. El presidente de la Agrupación Nacional de Empleados Fiscales de Chile, Raúl Puente, dijo que los trabajadores apoyan la lucha de los estudiantes.
La UNESCO ha dicho de que existe una gran segregación en la educación y eso hace de que hoy día luchemos por una educación pública de calidad, con equidad, para todos los trabajadores y trabajadoras de nuestro país. El Estado debe ser el garante de una educación pública de calidad para toda la ciudadanía y esto no puede quedarse circunscrito a los vaivenes del mercado, a una educación que solamente sea pagada.
La dirigente universitaria Camila Vallejo dijo que los estudiantes rechazan la mesa del diálogo del gobierno porque está condicionada y llamó a poner fin a la mercantilización de la educación.
Tenemos la fuerza suficiente para ir por el todo o nada. Nosotros creemos que aquí hay un respaldo transversal de muchísimos actores y nosotros queremos apuntar a los temas de fondo, no a medidas instrumentales que no van a resolver ningún caso el problema de la educación, sino que van a ser medidas parche y que por el contrario van a profundizar totalmente el modelo privatizador y mercantilizador de la educación superior. Entonces nosotros queremos respuestas concretas, de fondo. Es importante que hoy día se frene una cuestión que es ilegal. Lucrar en la educación es ilegal.
I'm Mitt Romney. I believe in America. And I'm running for president of the United States.
El ex gobernador de Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, anunció el jueves formalmente su candidatura a la presidencia de Estados Unidos en el 2012. Desde una granja en New Hampshire, el republicano multimillonario afirmó que su experiencia como empresario le sirvió para gobernar con éxito el estado de Massachusetts y que su prioridad